Blog Talk Radio.
From the case files of God's Gumshoe, Case 606, code name Ichabod.
Dear God's Gumshoe, my name is Ichabod. I'm a 14-year-old young man who is interested in finding the truth. I am told that God wrote a book called the Bible, and that this is the foundation document for the whole of Western civilization. I'm also told that it is without error, that every word of it is true, and that I should read it. But while I see that there are great truths within this book, there are also things that cannot possibly be true, and stories that tell the same event but are completely different. How can this be? Can you tell me how this book came about and who actually wrote this book? Thank you. Oh, I might have another question later. Ichabod.
Once again, thank you, Ichabod, and welcome to our other listeners. We are investigating the New Testament Bible, and we're doing it thematically rather than chronologically, which means that we're studying certain themes that are prominent and important in the New Testament Bible. These last few episodes, and this episode included, we've been studying the Gospel of Mark and the author. Who wrote this? Today, we're going to proceed a little bit deeper into that and investigate this author, Mark, supposedly John Mark. Later on, we will continue with some of our readings. We'll have these readings in the appropriate places for our study. We won't be doing them with all of the texts of the Bible. Time constraints just won't allow that. But we should be able to get enough of the readings in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, probably Acts and a few of the letters of Paul, to give us a good working knowledge of the actual text that's in the Bible, as well as a response from our theologians, our historians, and the Urantia Papers. So this is going to be very interesting now that we're into the text of the Bible. We've already had a reading of chapter 1 and chapter 2. We'll have more readings today, and we'll investigate exactly how this particular paper came about, primarily because this is the first of the Gospels that was written. Most theologians and historians agree about that, and that it served as a basis for both Matthew and Luke in their writing of their Gospels. So Mark becomes a very important text in this investigation and in understanding it right from the beginning. That's why we're doing Mark first. So let's proceed here. Let's see what it is that the Christians believe about Mark. What can we tell from reading the Bible about Mark? Well, Mark is presumed to be John Mark. The Christian church hold him as an evangelist in the early church and an early church leader, and as the author of the gospel book, which bears his name. In Acts 12, he's called John, also called Mark. And like many of the other apostles and disciples, he was known by two names. Mark, or Marcus, was a Roman name, and John was his Jewish name. He was called John in Acts 13, and Mark again in Acts 15. His Roman name was used as a title of the gospel, probably to avoid the confusion of having two gospel books written by John. That's why it's called Mark. What we know from the Bible is that Mark was the son of a woman named Mary, a prominent Christian woman who lived in and around Jerusalem, and he may have been born in and around Jerusalem, where his mother lived during the New Testament times. There's no record of his father's name, but Mark is described as having a cousin named Barnabas, and that's in Colossians, and later on Barnabas appears as one of the travelers and one of the associates of Paul. Mark's mother's house is identified as apparently a popular place for Christians to meet, and where many people gathered and prayed. This is where the title, the upper chamber, is identified, is that this was Mary Mark's house, and presumably his father's. It obviously was an important place because this is the first place where the Apostle Peter went, After an angel had sprung him from Herod's prison, he went right straight to Mark's house. Peter refers to Mark as his son in Peter 1. So it is likely that Peter was involved in Mark's conversion and Mark's growing up. That's obvious from what the Bible tells us, from the context and the text of the Bible. And Peter at that time would have been about 35 or 40 years old, and Mark was substantially younger. So Peter would have been a type of father figure to him, or a mentor in this apostolic movement. Although that it is quite likely that the younger man spoken of in Mark 14 was Mark himself, he is first mentioned by name in Acts 12. He accompanied Paul and Barnabas on their first journey, but for some reason returned home to Jerusalem after they had traveled as far as Perga. So the situation in this is that obviously Mark and Paul had a disagreement. Now, that's not unusual because Paul had a number of disagreements with many of the people who were close to Jesus in Jerusalem and in the Jerusalem center. The apostles who were in Jerusalem directing the affairs of the Jesus movement. Paul, as we know, broke away on his own and was having quite a dispute about evangelizing and converting the Gentiles, anyone who was not Jewish. In order to do that, of course, it involved changing dietary laws, it involved having penis surgery called circumcision, and in the Bible, a group go from Jerusalem to where Paul is, and they have a big dispute, and they're called the circumcisers. So Paul is in dispute with these people, and it's likely that Mark got caught up in this. Mark returns to Jerusalem. He later joins Paul again on another mission, and we know that he arrives in Rome with Peter. And this is probably where the Gospel of Peter was written, in Rome, under the direction of Peter, and probably whatever Mark had picked up on his own in compiling the document. We'll hear a little bit about that in a moment. But it's very clear that Mark, as far as the Christians are concerned, it's very clear that Mark was one of the fortunate few to have seen and heard Jesus during his human lifetime. He witnessed the birth and the growth of the Christian church, and he personally knew most of the greatest early Christians. Now, Watson has been doing some serious research, and he has uncovered some very interesting information from the Urantia papers about this young man, Mark, and his participation in the early Christian movements and his activities in and around the apostolic camp, working with the apostles and working with Jesus. Watson, tell us what you've uncovered.
John Mark was the errand boy for Jesus and the apostles, and he was an eyewitness to many important events in the life and teachings of Jesus Christ. On the morning of April 5th, AD 30, Jesus said, "I desire to go alone, that I may commune with the Father." As Jesus started off alone, John Mark came forward with a small basket containing food and water, and suggested that, if he intended to be away all day, he might find himself hungry. The Master smiled on John and reached down to take the basket. As Jesus was about to take the lunch basket from John's hand, the young man ventured to say, "But Master, you may set the basket down while you turn aside to pray and go on without it. Besides, if I should go along to carry the lunch, you would be more free to worship, and I will surely be silent. I will ask no questions and will stay by the basket when you go apart by yourself to pray." While making this speech, the temerity in which astonished some of the nearby listeners, John had made bold to hold on to the basket. There they stood, both John and Jesus holding the basket. Presently the Master let go, and looking down on the lad, said, "Since with all your heart you crave to go with me, it shall not be denied you. We will go off by ourselves and have a good visit. You may ask me any question that arises in your heart, and we will comfort and console each other. You may start out carrying the lunch, and when you grow weary, I will help you. Follow on with me." Jesus did not return to the camp that evening after sunset. The Master spent this last day of quiet on earth visiting with his truth-hungry youth and talking with his paradise Father. This event has become known on high as the day which a young man spent with God in the hills. Forever, this occasion exemplifies the willingness of the Creator to fellowship with the creature. Even a youth, if the desire of the heart is really supreme, can command the attention and enjoy the loving companionship of the God of a universe, actually experience this unforgettable ecstasy of being alone with God in the hills, and for a whole day. And such was the unique experience which John Mark on this Wednesday in the hills had in the hills of Judea. Jesus visited much with John, talking freely about the affairs of this world and the next. John told Jesus how much he regretted that he had not been old enough to be one of the apostles, and expressed his great appreciation that he had been permitted to follow on with them since their first preaching at the Jordan Ford near Jericho, except for the trip to Phoenicia. Jesus warned the lad not to become discouraged by impending events and assured him he would live to become a mighty messenger of the kingdom. John Mark was thrilled by the memory of this day with Jesus in the hills, but he never forgot the Master's final admonition, spoken just as they were about to retire to the Gethsemane camp, when he said, "Well, John, we have had a good visit, a real day of rest, but see to it that you tell no man the things which I told you." And John Mark never did reveal anything that transpired on this day which he spent with Jesus in the hills. When up in the hills that day with Jesus, the lad asked the Master how he could know that he would turn out to be a mighty messenger of the kingdom. Jesus said in part, "I know you will prove loyal to the gospel of the kingdom, because I can depend upon your present faith and love when these qualities are grounded upon such a early training as been your portion at home. You are the product of a home where the parents bear each other a sincere affection. Therefore, you have not been overloved so as to injuriously to exalt your concept of self-importance. Neither has your personality suffered distortion in consequence of your parents' loveless maneuvering for your confidence and loyalty, the one against the other. You have enjoyed that parental love which ensures laudable self-confidence, which fosters normal feelings of security. But you have also been fortunate in that your parents possess wisdom as well as love. And it was wisdom which led them to withhold most forms of indulgence and many luxuries which wealth can buy, while they sent you to the synagogue school along with your neighborhood playfellows. And they also encouraged you to learn how to live in this world by permitting you to have original experience. Love, John, is the supreme reality of the universe when bestowed by all wise beings. But it is dangerous and oftentimes semi-selfish trait when it is manifested in the experience of mortal parents. When you get married and have children of your own to rear, make sure that your love is admonished by wisdom and guided by intelligence. You possess a strong and well-knit character because you grew up in a home where love prevailed and wisdom reigned. Such a childhood training produces a type of loyalty which assures me that you will go through to the course you have begun." The Last Supper was held in the home of Elisha and Mary Mark, and John Mark helped to set this up. When the apostles reached the city, they met the man with the water pitcher near the gate and followed on after him to the home of John Mark, where the lad's father met them and showed them the upper room in readiness for the evening meal. And all this came to pass as a result of an understanding arrived between the Master and John Mark during the afternoon of the preceding day when they were alone in the hills. Jesus wanted to be sure he could have this one last meal undisturbed with his apostles, and believing if Judas knew beforehand of their place of meeting, he might arrange with his enemies to take him, he made this secret arrangement with John Mark. In this way, Judas did not learn of their place of meeting until later on when he arrived there in company with Jesus and the other apostles. John Mark had followed them all the way into the city after they had entered the gate. He hurried on by another street so that he was waiting to welcome them to his father's home when they arrived. It was about 10 o'clock this Thursday night when Jesus led the 11 apostles from the home of Elijah and John Mark on their way back to the Gethsemane camp. Ever since that day in the hills, John Mark had made it his business to keep a watchful eye on Jesus. John, being in need of sleep, had obtained several hours of rest while the Master had been with his apostles in the upper room. But on hearing them coming downstairs, he arose and, quickly throwing a linen coat about himself, followed them through the city, over the brook Kidron, and on to their private encampment adjacent to the Gethsemane Park. And John Mark remained so near the Master throughout this night and the next day that he witnessed everything and overheard much of what the Master said from this time on to the hour of the crucifixion. The betrayal of Jesus by Judas. Jesus sat down alone on the olive press where he awaited the coming of the betrayer and soldiers sent to arrest Jesus, and who was seen at this time only by John Mark and an innumerable host of celestial observers. When the guards started back to Jerusalem with Jesus, John Mark attempted to steal out of the shed in order to catch up with the fleeing apostles and disciples. But just as he emerged, one of the last of the returning soldiers who had pursued the fleeing disciples was passing near, and seeing this young man in his linen coat, gave chase, almost overtaking him. In fact, the soldier got near enough to John to lay hold upon his coat, but the young man freed himself from the garment, escaping while the soldier held the empty coat. John Mark made his way in all haste to David Zebedee on the upper trail. When he had told David what had happened, they both hastened back to the tents of the sleeping apostles and informed all eight of the Master's betrayal and arrest. After John Mark's escape from the clutch of the soldier, he provided himself with a cloak which he found in the tent of Simon Peter and John Zebedee. He suspected the guards were going to take Jesus to the home of Annas, the high priest emeritus, so he skirted around through the olive orchards and was there ahead of the mob, hiding near the entrance to the gate of the high priest's palace. After the Friday crucifixion of Jesus, late Saturday night, John Mark summoned the 11 apostles secretly to come to the home of his father, where just before midnight they all assembled in the same upper chamber where they had partaken of the Last Supper with their Master two nights previously. The apostles' isolation had much to do with their troubles. John Mark kept them in touch with developments about the temple and informed them as to the many rumors gaining headway in the city. But it did not occur to him to gather up news from the different groups of believers to whom Jesus had already appeared. After his crucifixion, he appeared to many times to many people. John Mark was with the apostles when the resurrected Jesus appeared at a lake. John Mark arose one morning and, seeing the apostles coming ashore with heavy laden net, ran down the beach to greet them. And when he saw 11 men instead of 10, he surmised that the unrecognized one was the risen Jesus. And as the astonished 10 stood by in silence, the youth rushed up to the Master and, kneeling at his feet, said, "My Lord and my Master." And when Jesus spoke, not as he had in Jerusalem, when he had greeted them with "Peace be upon you," but in commonplace tones he addressed John Mark, "Well, John, I am glad to see you again and in carefree Galilee, where we can have a good visit. Stay with us, John, and have breakfast." It was a sad homecoming for John Mark on May 3rd, A.D. 30. Just a few hours before he reached home, his father, Elijah Mark, suddenly died from a hemorrhage in the brain. Although the thought of the certainty of the resurrection of the dead did much to comfort the apostles in their grief, at the same time they truly mourned the loss of their good friend, who had been their staunch supporter even in the times of great trouble and disappointment. John Mark did all he could to comfort his mother, and, speaking for her, invited the apostles to continue to make their home at her house. And the 11 made this upper chamber their headquarters until the day of Pentecost, May 18th.
Thank you, Watson. Good job. Now, we're going to go to paper 21 of the Urantia Papers for a reading on exactly how and when the Gospel of Mark was compiled. Here, from paper 21 of the Urantia Papers, Mark, the Gospel of Mark, and how it came into creation.
It has been our purpose also to make use of the so-called Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. These New Testament records had their origin in the following circumstances. 1. The Gospel by Mark. John Mark wrote the earliest, excepting the notes of Andrew, briefest and most simple record of Jesus' life. He presented the Master as a minister, as man among men. Although Mark was a lad lingering about many of the scenes which he depicts, his record is in reality the Gospel according to Simon Peter. He was early associated with Peter, later with Paul. Mark wrote this record at the instigation of Peter and on the earnest petition of the Church at Rome. Knowing how consistently the Master refused to write out his teachings when on earth and in the flesh, Mark, like the apostles and other leading disciples, was hesitant to put them in writing. But Peter felt the Church at Rome required the assistance of such a written narrative, and Mark consented to undertake its preparation. He made many notes before Peter died in A.D. 67, and, in accordance with the outline approved by Peter and for the Church at Rome, he began his writing soon after Peter's death. The Gospel was completed near the end of A.D. 68. Mark wrote entirely from his own memory and Peter's memory. The record has since been considerably changed, numerous passages having been taken out, and some later material added at the end to replace the latter one-fifth of the original Gospel, which was lost from the first manuscript before it was ever copied. This record by Mark, in conjunction with Andrew's and Matthew's notes, was the written basis of all subsequent Gospel narratives which sought to portray the life and teachings of Jesus.
Thank you. That was excellent. It has also set us up so that now we can begin to take an investigation into each of the Gospels and to begin to look at the text, analyze the text, compare it across the lines of discussion with the theologians, with the Urantia papers, and really get a sense of the truth that will emerge out of that. In order to do that, we're going to now have a reading on the text to begin to familiarize ourselves with the basic story of what exactly Mark is telling us. We will then expand this next week into Matthew and Luke, and further on then into John. So, enjoy this. This is terrific. Here, once again, Max MacLean in the performance presenting the Gospel of Mark, Chapter 3, The Appointing of the Apostles. We will follow this with the Urantia Papers discussion on the appointing of the apostles. Now, here's Max.
Another time he was in the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Then Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" But they remained silent. Jesus looked at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the lake. A large crowd from Galilee followed. When they heard all he was doing, many people came to him from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, and the regions across the Jordan and around Tyre and Sidon. Because of the crowd, Jesus told his disciples to have a small boat ready for him to keep the people from crowding him, for he had healed many so that those with diseases were pushing forward to touch him. And whenever the evil spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God!" But he gave them strict orders not to tell who he was. Jesus went up on the mountainside and called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12, designating them to be apostles, that they might be with him, that he might send them out to preach and have authority to drive out demons. These are the 12 he appointed. Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. To them he gave the name Boanerges, which means sons of thunder. Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Then Jesus entered a house. Again a crowd gathered so that he and his disciples were not even able to eat. When his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him, for they said, he's out of his mind. And the teachers of the law, who had come down from Jerusalem, they said, he's possessed by Beelzebub. It is by the prince of demons he drives out demons. So Jesus called them and spoke to them in parables. How can Satan drive out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. If a house is divided against itself, that house cannot stand. And if Satan opposes himself and is divided, he cannot stand. His end is come. In fact, no one can enter a strong man's house and carry off his possessions unless he first ties up the strong man. Then he can rob his house. I tell you the truth. All the sins and blasphemies of men will be forgiven them. But whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit will never be forgiven. He is guilty of an eternal sin. He said this because they were saying that he has an evil spirit. Then Jesus' mother and brothers arrived. Standing outside, he sent someone to call him. A crowd was sitting around him. They told him, your mother and your brothers are outside looking for you. Who are my mother and my brothers? He asked. Then he looked at those seated in a circle around him and said, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my brother and sister and mother.
Thank you, Max. We can see how Mark really, or Peter in this case, really condenses the appointing of the apostles. This is a very important aspect of Jesus' ministry, and so I think now we need to take a look at paper 137 of the Urantia Papers to get the full story. Let's listen in.
Paper 137, Tarrying Time in Galilee. 1. Choosing the first four apostles. During this Sabbath, two of John's leading disciples spent much time with Jesus. Of all John's followers, one named Andrew was the most profoundly impressed with Jesus. He accompanied him on the trip to Pella with the injured boy. On the way back to John's rendezvous, he asked Jesus many questions, and just before reaching their destination, the two paused for a short talk, during which Andrew said, "I have observed you ever since you came to Capernaum, and I believe you are the new teacher. And though I do not understand all your teaching, I have fully made up my mind to follow you. I would sit at your feet and learn the whole truth about the new kingdom." And Jesus, with hearty assurance, welcomed Andrew as the first of his apostles, that group of 12 who were to labor with him in the work of establishing the new kingdom of God in the hearts of men. Andrew was a silent observer of and sincere believer in John's work. And he had a very able and enthusiastic brother named Simon, who was one of John's foremost disciples. It would not be amiss to say that Simon was one of John's chief supporters. Soon after Jesus and Andrew returned to the camp, Andrew sought out his brother Simon, and taking him aside, informed him that he had settled in his own mind that Jesus was the great teacher, and that he had pledged himself as a disciple. He went on to say that Jesus had accepted his proffer of service and suggested that he, Simon, likewise go to Jesus and offer himself for fellowship in the service of the new kingdom. Said Simon,
Ever since this man came to work in Zebedee's shop, I have believed he was sent by God. But what about John? Are we to forsake him? Is this the right thing to do? Whereupon they agreed to go at once to consult John. John was saddened by the thought of losing two of his able advisers and most promising disciples, but he bravely answered their inquiry, saying, "This is but the beginning. Presently will my work end, and we shall all become his disciples." Then Andrew beckoned to Jesus to draw aside, while he announced that his brother desired to join himself to the service of the new kingdom. And in welcoming Simon as his second apostle, Jesus said, "Simon, your enthusiasm is commendable, but it is dangerous to the work of the kingdom. I admonish you to become more thoughtful in your speech. I would change your name to Peter." The parents of the injured lad who lived at Pella had besought Jesus to spend the night with them to make their house his home, and he had promised. Before leaving Andrew and his brother, Jesus said, "Early on the morrow we go into Galilee." After Jesus had returned to Pella for the night, and while Andrew and Simon were yet discussing the nature of their service in the establishment of the forthcoming kingdom, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, arrived upon the scene, having just returned from their long and futile searching in the hills for Jesus. When they heard Simon Peter tell how he and his brother Andrew had become the first accepted counselors of the new kingdom, and that they were to leave with their new master on the morrow for Galilee, both James and John were sad. They had known Jesus for some time, and they loved him. They had searched for him many days in the hills, and now they returned to learn that others had been preferred before them. They inquired where Jesus had gone, and made haste to find him. Jesus was asleep when they reached his abode, but they awakened him, saying, "How is it that, while we who have so long lived with you are searching in the hills for you, you prefer others before us, and choose Andrew and Simon as your first associates in the new kingdom?" Jesus answered them, "Be calm in your hearts, and ask yourselves, who directed that you should search for the Son of Man when he was about his Father's business?" After they had recited the details of their long search in the hills, Jesus further instructed them, "You should learn to search for the secret of the new kingdom in your hearts, and not in the hills. That which you sought was already present in your souls. You are indeed my brethren. You needed not to be received by me. Already were you of the kingdom, and you should be of good cheer, making ready also to go with us tomorrow into Galilee." John then made bold to ask, "But Master, will James and I be associates with you in the new kingdom, even as Andrew and Simon?" And Jesus, laying a hand on the shoulder of each of them, said, "My brethren, you were already with me in the spirit of the kingdom, even before these others made request to be received. You, my brethren, have no need to make request for entrance into the kingdom. You have been with me in the kingdom from the beginning. Before men, others may take precedence over you, but in my heart did I also number you in the councils of the kingdom, even before you thought to make this request of me. And even so, might you have been first before men, had you not been absent, engaged in a well-intentioned but self-appointed task of seeking for one who was not lost. In the coming kingdom, be not mindful of those things which foster your anxiety, but rather at all times concern yourselves only with doing the will of the Father who is in heaven." James and John received the rebuke in good grace. Never more were they envious of Andrew and Simon. And they made ready, with their two associate apostles, to depart for Galilee the next morning. From this day on, the term apostle was employed to distinguish the chosen family of Jesus' advisers from the vast multitude of believing disciples who subsequently followed him. Late that evening, James, John, Andrew, and Simon held converse with John the Baptist, and with tearful eye but steady voice, the stalwart Judean prophet surrendered two of his leading disciples to become the apostles of the Galilean prince of the coming kingdom. Two, choosing Philip and Nathanael. Sunday morning, February 24, AD 26, Jesus took leave of John the Baptist by the river Pella, never again to see him in the flesh. That day, as Jesus and his four disciple apostles departed for Galilee, there was a great tumult in the camp of John's followers. The first great division was about to take place. The day before, John had made his positive pronouncement to Andrew and Ezra that Jesus was the deliverer. Andrew decided to follow Jesus, but Ezra rejected the mild-mannered carpenter of Nazareth, proclaiming to his associates, "The prophet Daniel declares that the Son of Man will come with the clouds of heaven in power and great glory. This Galilean carpenter, this Capernaum boat builder, cannot be the deliverer. Can such a gift of God come out of Nazareth? This Jesus is a relative of John, and through much kindness of heart has our teacher been deceived. Let us remain aloof from this false Messiah." When John rebuked Ezra for these utterances, he drew away with many disciples and hastened south. And this group continued to baptize in John's name, and eventually founded a sect of those who believed in John but refused to accept Jesus. A remnant of this group persists in Mesopotamia even to this day. While this trouble was brewing among John's followers, Jesus and his four disciple apostles were well on their way toward Galilee. Before they crossed the Jordan to go by way of Nain to Nazareth, Jesus, looking ahead and up the road, saw one Philip of Bethsaida with a friend coming toward them. Jesus had known Philip aforetime, and he was also well known to all four of the new apostles. He was on his way with his friend Nathanael to visit John at Pella to learn more about the reported coming of the kingdom of God, and he was delighted to greet Jesus. Philip had been an admirer of Jesus ever since he first came to Capernaum, but Nathanael, who lived at Cana of Galilee, did not know Jesus. Philip went forward to greet his friends while Nathanael rested under the shade of a tree by the roadside. Peter took Philip to one side and proceeded to explain that they, referring to himself, Andrew, James, and John, had all become associates of Jesus in the new kingdom and strongly urged Philip to volunteer for service. Philip was in a quandary. What should he do? Here, without a moment's warning, on the roadside near the Jordan, there had come up for immediate decision the most momentous question of a lifetime. By this time he was in earnest converse with Peter, Andrew, and John, while Jesus was outlining to James the trip through Galilee and on to Capernaum. Finally, Andrew suggested to Philip, "Why not ask the teacher?" It suddenly dawned on Philip that Jesus was a really great man, possibly the Messiah, and he decided to abide by Jesus' decision in this matter. And he went straight to him, asking, "Teacher, shall I go down to John, or shall I join my friends who follow you?" And Jesus answered, "Follow me." Philip was thrilled with the assurance that he had found the deliverer. Philip now motioned to the group to remain where they were while he hurried back to break the news of his decision to his friend Nathanael, who still tarried behind under the mulberry tree, turning over in his mind the many things which he had heard concerning John the Baptist, the coming kingdom, and the expected Messiah. Philip broke in upon these meditations, exclaiming, "I have found the deliverer, him of whom Moses and the prophets wrote, and whom John has proclaimed." Nathanael, looking up, inquired, "Whence comes this teacher?" And Philip replied, "He is Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph the carpenter, more recently residing at Capernaum." And then, somewhat shocked, Nathanael asked, "Can any such good thing come out of Nazareth?" But Philip, taking him by the arm, said, "Come and see." Philip led Nathanael to Jesus, who, looking benignly into the face of the sincere doubter, said, "Behold a genuine Israelite in whom there is no deceit. Follow me." And Nathanael, turning to Philip, said, "You are right, he is indeed a master of men. I will also follow, if I am worthy." And Jesus nodded to Nathanael, again saying, "Follow me." Jesus had now assembled one half of his future core of intimate associates, five who had for some time known him, and one stranger, Nathanael. Without further delay, they crossed the Jordan and, going by the village of Nain, reached Nazareth late that evening. They all remained overnight with Joseph in Jesus' boyhood home. The associates of Jesus little understood why their newfound teacher was so concerned with completely destroying every vestige of his writing which remained about the home in the form of the Ten Commandments and other mottos and sayings. But this proceeding, together with the fact that they never saw him subsequently write, except upon the dust or in the sand, made a deep impression upon their minds.
two, choosing the six. This first missionary tour of the six was eminently successful. They all discovered the great value of direct and personal contact with men. They returned to Jesus more fully realizing that, after all, religion is purely and wholly a matter of personal experience. They began to sense how hungry were the common people to hear words of religious comfort and spiritual good cheer. When they assembled about Jesus, they all wanted to talk at once. But Andrew assumed charge, and as he called upon them one by one, they made their formal reports to the Master and presented their nominations for the six new apostles. Jesus, after each man had presented his selection for the new apostleships, asked all the others to vote upon the nomination. Thus, all six of the new apostles were formally accepted by all of the older six. Then Jesus announced that they would all visit these candidates and give them the call to service. The newly selected apostles were 1. Matthew Levi, the customs collector of Capernaum, who had his office just to the east of the city, near the borders of Bethania. He was selected by Andrew. 2. Thomas Didymus, a fisherman of Tarichaea and one-time carpenter and stonemason of Gadara. He was selected by Philip. 3. James Alphaeus, a fisherman and farmer of Caressa, was selected by James Zebedee. 4. Judas Alphaeus, the twin brother of James Alphaeus, also a fisherman, was selected by John Zebedee. 5. Simon Zelotes was a high officer in the patriotic organization of the Zealots, a position which he gave up to join Jesus' apostles. Before joining the Zealots, Simon had been a merchant. He was selected by Peter. 6. Judas Iscariot was an only son of wealthy Jewish parents living in Jericho. He had become attached to John the Baptist, and his Sadducee parents had disowned him. He was looking for employment in these regions when Jesus' apostles found him, and chiefly because of his experience with finances, Nathanael invited him to join their ranks. Judas Iscariot was the only Judean among the 12 apostles. Jesus spent a full day with the six, answering their questions and listening to the details of their reports, for they had many interesting and profitable experiences to relate. They now saw the wisdom of the Master's plan of sending them out to labor in a quiet and personal manner before the launching of their more pretentious public efforts.
So now Jesus has organized the 12 apostles, and he's out teaching, and they very quickly learn his method of teaching, which is by parables. Here, the parables of Jesus as seen from the Bible, and the parables of Jesus as seen from the Urantia Papers.
Another time he began to teach by the lake. The crowd that gathered was so large that he got into a boat and sat in it out on the lake, with all the people along the shore at the water's edge. He taught them many things by parables, and in his teaching said, "Listen! A farmer went out to sow his seed. And as he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Some fell on rocky places where it did not have much soil, sprang up quickly because the soil was shallow. But when the sun came up, the plants were scorched and withered because they had no root. Others fell among thorns which grew up and choked the plants so that they did not bear grain. Still others fell on good soil, came up, grew, produced a crop multiplying 30, 60, or even 100 times. Then Jesus said to them, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." When he was alone, the 12 and the others around him asked him about this parable. He told them, "The secret of the kingdom of God has been given to you. But to those on the outside, everything is said in parables so that they may be ever seeing and never perceiving, and ever hearing but never understanding. Otherwise they might turn and be forgiven." Then Jesus said to them, "Don't you understand this parable?" "How then will you understand any parable? The farmer sows the word. Some people are like seeds sown along the path. As soon as they hear the word, Satan comes and takes away the word sown in them. Others, like seeds sown on rocky places, hear the word and at once receive it with joy. But since they have no root, they last only a short time. When trouble or persecution comes because of the word, they quickly fall away. Still others, like seeds sown among thorns, hear the word, but the worries of this life and the deceitfulness of wealth and the desire for other things come in and choke the word, making it unfruitful. Others, like seeds sown on good soil, hear the word, accept it, and grow 30, 60, or even 100 times what was sown. He said to them, "Do you bring in a lamp and put it under a bowl or a bed? Instead, don't you put it on its stand? Whatever's hidden is meant to be disclosed. Whatever's concealed is meant to be brought out into the open. If anyone has ears to hear, let him hear." He continued, "With the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Even more so, whoever has will be given more. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him." He also said, "This is what the kingdom of God is like. A man scatters seed on the ground. Night and day, whether he sleeps or gets up, the seed sprouts and grows. All by itself, the soil produces grain, though he does not know how. First the stalk, then the head, then the full kernel in the head. As soon as the grain is ripe, he puts the sickle to it because the harvest has come." Again he said, "What shall we say the kingdom of God is like? What parable shall we use to describe it? It's like a mustard seed, which is the smallest seed you plant in the ground. Yet when planted, it becomes the largest of all garden plants, with such big branches that the birds in the air can perch in its shade." With many similar parables, he spoke the word to them, as much as they could understand. He did not say anything to them without using a parable. But when he was alone with his disciples, he explained everything. That day, when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up and the waves broke over the boat. It was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." The wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and said to each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him."
One, the parable of the sower. About this time, Jesus first began to employ the parable method of teaching the multitudes that so frequently gathered about him. Since Jesus had talked with the apostles and others long into the night on this Sunday morning, very few of the group were up for breakfast. So he went out by the seaside and sat alone in the boat, the old fishing boat of Andrew and Peter, which was always kept at his disposal. And he meditated on the next move to be made in the work of extending the kingdom. But the master was not to be alone for long. Very soon the people from Capernaum and nearby villages began to arrive, and by 10 o'clock that morning almost 1,000 were assembled on shore near Jesus' boat and were clamoring for attention. Peter was now up, and making his way to the boat, said to Jesus, "Master, shall I talk to them?" But Jesus answered, "No, Peter, I will tell them a story." And then Jesus began the recital of the parable of the sower, one of the first of a long series of such parables, which he taught to the throngs that followed after him.
This boat had an elevated seat on which he sat, for it was the custom to sit when teaching, while he talked to the crowd assembled along the shore. After Peter had spoken a few words, Jesus said, "A sower went forth to sow, and it came to pass as he sowed that some of the seed fell by the wayside to be trodden underfoot and devoured by the birds of heaven. Other seed fell upon the rocky places where there was little earth, and immediately it sprang up because there was no depth to the soil, but as soon as the sun shone, it withered because it had no root whereby to secure moisture. Other seed fell among the thorns, and as the thorns grew up, it was choked so that it yielded no grain. Still other seed fell upon the good ground, and, growing, yielded some 30-fold, some 60-fold, and some 100-fold. And when he had finished speaking this parable, he said to the multitude, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." The apostles and those who were with them, when they heard Jesus teach the people in this manner, were greatly perplexed. And after much talking among themselves, that evening in the Zebedee garden, Matthew said to Jesus, "Master, what is the meaning of the dark sayings which you present to the multitude? Why do you speak in parables to those who seek the truth?" And Jesus answered, "In patience have I instructed you all this time. To you it is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to the undiscerning multitudes and to those who seek our destruction, from now on the mysteries of the kingdom shall be presented in parables. And this we will do so that those who really desire to enter the kingdom may discern the meaning of the teaching and thus find salvation, while those who listen only to ensnare us may be the more confounded in that they will see without seeing and will hear without hearing. My children, do you not perceive the law of the Spirit which decrees that to him who has shall be given so that he shall have an abundance, but from him who has not shall be taken away even that which he has? Therefore will I henceforth speak to the people much in parables, to the end that our friends and those who desire to know the truth may find that which they seek, while our enemies and those who love not the truth may hear without understanding. Many of these people follow not in the way of the truth. The prophet did indeed describe all such undiscerning souls when he said, 'For this people's heart has waxed gross, and their ears are dull of hearing, and their eyes they have closed lest they should discern the truth and understand it in their hearts.'" The apostles did not fully comprehend the significance of the Master's words. As Andrew and Thomas talked further with Jesus, Peter and the other apostles withdrew to another portion of the garden, where they engaged in earnest and prolonged discussion. 2. Interpretation of the parable. Peter and the group about him came to the conclusion that the parable of the sower was an allegory, that each feature had some hidden meaning, and so they decided to go to Jesus and ask for an explanation. Accordingly, Peter approached the Master, saying, "We are not able to penetrate the meaning of this parable, and we desire that you explain it to us, since you say it has given us to know the mysteries of the kingdom." And when Jesus heard this, he said to Peter, "My son, I desire to withhold nothing from you, but first, suppose you tell me what you have been talking about. What is your interpretation of the parable?" After a moment of silence, Peter said, "Master, we have talked much concerning the parable, and this is the interpretation I have decided upon. The sower is the gospel preacher. The seed is the word of God. The seed which fell by the wayside represents those who do not understand the gospel teaching. The birds which snatched away the seed that fell upon the hardened ground represent Satan, or the evil one, who steals away that which has been sown in the hearts of these ignorant ones. The seed which fell upon the rocky places, and which sprang up so suddenly, represents those superficial and unthinking persons who, when they hear the glad tidings, receive the message with joy, but because the truth has no real root in their deeper understanding, their devotion is short-lived in the face of tribulation and persecution. When trouble comes, these believers stumble. They fall away when tempted. The seed which fell among thorns represents those who hear the word willingly, but who allow the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches to choke the word of truth so that it becomes unfruitful. Now the seed which fell on good ground and sprang up to bear some 30, some 60, and some 100-fold represents those who, when they have heard the truth, receive it with varying degrees of appreciation, owing to their differing intellectual endowments, and hence manifest these varying degrees of religious experience.
Jesus, after listening to Peter's interpretation of the parable, asked the other apostles if they did not also have suggestions to offer. To this invitation only Nathanael responded. Said he, "Master, while I recognize many good things about Simon Peter's interpretation of the parable, I do not fully agree with him. My idea of this parable would be, the seed represents the gospel of the kingdom, while the sower stands for the messengers of the kingdom. The seed which fell by the wayside on hardened ground represents those who have heard but little of the gospel, along with those who are indifferent to the message, and who have hardened their hearts. The birds of the sky that snatched away the seed which fell by the wayside represent one's habits of life, the temptation of evil, and the desires of the flesh. The seed which fell among the rocks stands for those emotional souls who are quick to receive new teaching, and equally quick to give up the truth when confronted with the difficulties and realities of living up to this truth. They lack spiritual perception. The seed which fell among the thorns represents those who are attracted to the truths of the gospel. They are minded to follow its teachings, but they are prevented by the pride of life, jealousy, envy, and the anxieties of human existence. The seed which fell on good soil, springing up to bear some 30, some 60, and some 100-fold, represents the natural and varying degrees of ability to comprehend truth and respond to its spiritual teachings by men and women who possess diverse endowments of spirit illumination." When Nathanael had finished speaking, the apostles and their associates fell into serious discussion and engaged in earnest debate, some contending for the correctness of Peter's interpretation, while almost an equal number sought to defend Nathanael's explanation of the parable. Meanwhile, Peter and Nathanael had withdrawn to the house, where they were involved in a vigorous and determined effort, the one to convince and change the mind of the other. The master permitted this confusion to pass the point of most intense expression. Then he clapped his hands and called them about him. When they had all gathered around him once more, he said, "Before I tell you about this parable, do any of you have aught to say?" Following a moment of silence, Thomas spoke up. "Yes, Master, I wish to say a few words. I remember that you once told us to beware of this very thing. You instructed us that, when using illustrations for our preaching, we should employ true stories, not fables, and that we should select a story best suited to the illustration of the one central and vital truth which we wished to teach the people, and that, having so used the story, we should not attempt to make a spiritual application of all the minor details involved in the telling of the story. I hold that Peter and Nathanael are both wrong in their attempts to interpret this parable. I admire their ability to do these things, but I am equally sure that all such attempts to make a natural parable yield spiritual analogies in all its features can only result in confusion and serious misconception of the true purpose of such a parable. That I am right is fully proved by the fact that, whereas we were all of one mind an hour ago, now we are divided into two separate groups who hold different opinions concerning this parable, and hold such opinions so earnestly as to interfere, in my opinion, with our ability fully to grasp the great truth which you had in mind when you presented this parable to the multitude, and subsequently asked us to make comment upon it." The words which Thomas spoke had a quieting effect on all of them. He caused them to recall what Jesus had taught them on former occasions. And before Jesus resumed speaking, Andrew arose, saying, "I am persuaded that Thomas is right, and I would like to have him tell us what meaning he attaches to the parable of the sower." After Jesus had beckoned Thomas to speak, he said, "My brethren, I did not wish to prolong this discussion, but if you so desire, I will say that I think this parable was spoken to teach us one great truth, and that is that our teaching of the gospel of the kingdom, no matter how faithfully and efficiently we execute our divine commissions, is going to be attended by varying degrees of success, and that all such differences in results are directly due to conditions inherent in the circumstances of our ministry, conditions over which we have little or no control." When Thomas had finished speaking, the majority of his fellow preachers were about ready to agree with him. Even Peter and Nathanael were on their way over to speak with him, when Jesus arose and said, "Well done, Thomas. You have discerned the true meaning of parables. But both Peter and Nathanael have done you all equal good in that they have so fully shown the danger of undertaking to make an allegory out of my parables. In your own hearts, you may often profitably engage in such flights of the speculative imagination, but you make a mistake when you seek to offer such conclusions as a part of your public teaching." Now that the tension was over, Peter and Nathaniel congratulated each other on their interpretations, and with the exception of the Alpheus twins, each of the apostles ventured to make an interpretation of the parable of the sower before they retired for the night. Even Judas Iscariot offered a very plausible interpretation. The 12 would often, among themselves, attempt to figure out the Master's parables as they would an allegory, but never again did they regard such speculations seriously. This was a very profitable session for the apostles and their associates, especially so, since from this time on Jesus more and more employed parables in connection with his public teaching.
And with that, we will close this week's episode. Please come back next week, and we'll pick it up right from where we left off. Thank you. We would like to thank the Urantia Book Fellowship for their sponsorship, and we would like to thank Cosmic Citizen for allowing God's Gumshoe to broadcast under the Cosmic Citizen's banner. Thank you. Join us next week, another exciting week. Bye now.